talking about, what we've kind of been doing for the new year, is just talking about how lots of times we make goals and resolutions for the new year. And rather talking about new resolutions, I want to deal with all your old broken ones this morning, because I think we probably have more broken ones than we do kept ones, and failure is a reality of life. And the Bible says, regardless of what kind of circumstances have come your way, Paul actually said, he made this amazing claim. He said that he had found the secret of contentment regardless of his exterior circumstances. He had this incredible emotional equilibrium that was just, he said, was solid even when he was broke or when he had plenty. Regardless of what was happening, he was doing solid. And so he said that this wasn't necessarily a secret that he had found, but he said he had learned. So it's a process. But we're kind of looking at the process of what the Bible says. We're kind of exploring the scriptures. And what do the scriptures say to us about contentment? How we can live a contented life regardless of what comes our way. So what we did last Sunday, we started looking at some of the Psalms. And I'm going to continue that this morning. I think one of the things that you're going to need to be able to process and be content are your feelings. Feelings are the things that make us feel up, and they can make us feel down. And how do we deal with our feelings? So we're going to look again this morning. I'm going to look at Psalm. Read along. It's only 8 verses. I'm going to read that Psalm quickly, and then we'll get into it a little deeper. Most Bibles put on there the title or what inspired this psalm. And what inspired this psalm, it says it was a psalm written by David when he was fleeing from Absalom, his son. Fleeing from his own son. So you think you got problems with your kids. Have you ever had to actually run from one of your kids? So talk about problems, okay? This guy's got serious problems. Not only is his son running after him and he's trying to flee from him, his son has gathered a group of rebels to try and imprison and kill his dad. Talk about some serious kid problems, all right? So here's what David writes. Verse 1 of Psalm 3 says, "Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there's no deliverance for him in God. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the one who lifts my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. I lay down and slept." Did you hear that? You're talking about his son chasing him with armies, and what does he say? I lay down and slept. Somebody besides Paul, I think, discovered the secret to contentment. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000 people who have set themselves against me round about. Arise, Lord, save me, O my God, for you have smitten my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be upon your people. That's one of the main things about the Psalms that we talked about last week, is that the Psalms seem to give us a unique way to deal with our circumstances that create feelings. In the religious sector, often, they're uncomfortable with feelings. We kind of are encouraged to stuff our feelings lots of times. We like to keep it to nice trimmed prayers and creeds that cut out any expression of emotionalism. And so we kind of stay in that safe place. And so that's the one side of the spectrum. Often there's an uncomfortability where we stuff our feelings. We deny our feelings. On the other end of the spectrum, sometimes in the world, there's a place where you almost to the point where you bow to your feelings, and almost where feelings become an end in yourself. Like, what you're feeling is what you should go with, because that's what your inner self is telling you. But what the Psalms say is to neither stuff your feelings or to completely submit and bow to your feelings, but what the Psalms say is to pray your feelings. It's kind of a unique thing that they tell us. And last week we looked at that. A lot of the Psalms talk about praying your sorrows and your griefs. Psalms of Lamentations. There's more of those than any other that deal with that particular feeling. But the one we're looking at today in Psalm 3, I would say, is probably a close second. And that's when it comes to dealing with our fears. And so David's praying his fears here. And he actually has two kinds of fears that he's dealing with here. Two levels is one way I heard it put. There's two levels of fear. In the first line, he says, "O Lord, my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me." That's exterior fear that's coming from the outside, physically threatened from these armies. So there's a fear that's real from the outside. Physical fear, he's afraid of getting hurt. The second one is an interior fear that comes from the inside. He says, "Many are saying of my soul," inside, "there is no deliverance for him in God." So they're creating fear by attacking him and who he is and saying, "Listen, man, you've blown it. God's not going to be there for you." So he's dealing with outside fear. He's dealing with fear coming in from the inside. And I think we could all relate to fear. Everybody here has experienced it. As a matter of fact, I think it's the first emotion that we experience when we come into this world, right? I mean, I've seen three kids born, my own three. And every time they came into the world, they were crying. And they weren't depressed. I think that's too complex. You know, it wasn't like, "Oh, geez, now I got to deal for this place for another 80 to 100 years. You know, they didn't know any of that. What was it? They were scared. They were fearful. What's going on? What happened to those warm walls that I had all this time? You know, what's he putting that finger in my mouth for? What are you hitting me for? What's going on? What's happening?" It's like a fear. So it was probably the first emotion that we experienced was fear. The problem is that it doesn't stop there, and it turns into deeper and deeper type of fear that end up debilitating and paralyzing us in many ways. So we're going to look at this and see how, right in the middle of all of these fears, how is it that David gets to this place where he says, "I will not fear," even though he's got all this stuff going on. As a matter of fact, he says, "I'm going to take a nap. I'm going to go to bed. I'm going to get some sleep." Wouldn't that be nice? The secret of contentment. Now, I know most of us don't have armies after us like David did. But we got troubles, we have challenges, we have disappointments that can feel like an army's after you, right? You know what? Actually, an army may be after you. You know what Jesus said? He says there's an enemy that's more powerful than any military army there is. And his agenda is to kill, steal, and destroy. Paul said there's a spiritual dimension where there are actually armies. He says there's principalities and powers, rulers of the darkness, spiritual wickedness in high places. So there's a spiritual reality to all this stuff, and it capitalizes, I think, many times on our vulnerabilities where we have things that we're fearful about, and on both levels. Let's look at the physical level, the exterior level first, and then we'll go into the inside level of fear. First, the outside level, where David's just dealing with there are armies out there, and he's worried he's going to get hurt. I think there are fears. We talked about this a little bit at men's group on Tuesday morning, and it just kind of came to me that, you know, there's good fear and there's bad fear. Proverbs encourages us to fear, but it says to fear the Lord. But then it also talks about a fear that perfect love needs to cast out. So God's not going to send his perfect love so he can cast out what he told you to have, right? So why does he say fear the Lord, but then perfect love casts out fear? Because there's godly fear fear that motivates us, and there's human fear that incapacitates us. But you know what? There's also, I think, healthy human fear and unhealthy human fear. There's a healthy human fear when you're threatened in the outside physical world that will save your life. Maybe it has in certain cases. It's what saved David. If you read about this story where his son was rebelling against him in 2 Samuel chapters 15 through 18, I think there were a lot of times, man, when his fear just kicked in and it gave him where there's something that happens when your adrenaline kicks in and it marshals all of your physical faculties in a burst of energy to be able to do something perhaps that you never would have ever able to do otherwise, maybe save your life. It happened to me. I think I've mentioned this before, but one of the best examples that I can remember for myself that I feel like I really maybe saved my life, I have this thing, you know, most of you know I have a dog, right? But I got a little dog. I have this thing with big dogs if I don't know them, you know? And the thing is with dogs, they know when you're nervous. That's what I hate, you know? You can't trick them, you know? It's like, you know, he knows that guy. He's nervous. Watch this. See, I told you. So I walked into this house. This is about 30-some years ago. And I walked in, and this guy had this German Shepherd. And he's growling at me, and he does not look nice. And the more I'm standing at the guy's front door, the meaner the dog looks, until finally I just panicked. And I turned around, and I bolted out the guy's front door. And the dog was coming after me. I don't know. I looked this up on the internet. It says that German Shepherds are capable of running upwards over 30 miles per hour. Ready for this? I outran him. Now check this out. I said, wait a minute. How could that be? So I went on the internet and I took a look to see who's the fastest human. It's that guy Bolt from Jamaica, right? Before him, they said they had actually gotten to the point where they said it's got to level out. Looking at the human anatomy, it's impossible for a human to run more than 25 miles an hour because of the way the ligaments and the muscles, you're going to get injured. You can't do it. Well, this guy totally blew him away because he's clocked at 28 miles an hour now. Meanwhile, I'm wondering, did I beat Bolt's record, man, when I bolted away from the German Shepherd, man? You know, that's what happens. See, God has wired us with the ability to do things that we couldn't normally do, and it's a healthy fear. It can save your life. Check this out. I found this thing, this guy, Rush, I guess you pronounce it Dozier or Dozier. He's some guy from, you know, studies all this stuff. And he says, we have a fear process that can detect danger within a tenth of a second of initial perception, before conscious decision-making has a chance to kick in, right? We call it that knee-jerk reaction, right? You just, your reflexes just kick in before you even had a chance to think about it. When that happens, our bodies go into action. Quick energy hormones like adrenaline get pumped into muscles and the bloodstream. This is interesting. Blood drains from the skin's surface. That's why sometimes you have a pale look when you get scared. It drains from the skin surface and gets diverted. Here we go. I got it away from this German Shepherd. And gets diverted into large muscles like the legs for quick getaway. Case in point here. Your heart pounds to enable your body to go into overdrive. The eyes widen and the pupils expand to take in the maximum amount of information. We thought it was just a comedy thing, you know, the cartoon when the eyes, you get scared, boy, yo, 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 right? That really happens, man. Many of the body's other systems for reproduction, digestion, and so on shut down so that your energy can be more focused and mobilize you for action. So there is such a thing as healthy human fear. It's usually external, and David expresses it times, I think, in the stories where you see how he's running from these guys, he's dealing with stuff. There's a autonomic, I think they call it, nervous system that kicks in and gives you the ability to do things beyond your normal ability. Here's the problem. If fear only happened when it was truly needed, right? Like situations like that. You know, when you're trying to not be eaten by a German shepherd, or you're trying to not be struck by a truck, or you're trying to outrun, some homicidal maniac, then fear would be nothing to worry about. It'd be a great thing to have. It'd save our life. It's just there, and it checks in when you need it, and then it checks out when you don't need it anymore. The problem is that most of us, fear strikes when it's neither helpful or wanted. That's the problem. It can get attached to what has not truly threatened us, right? It's not really threatened us, but we feel it, and then we become paralyzed instead of motivated. What is it? The EAR, false expectations appearing real. And it just immobilizes you. That's the problem. Remember, I said, now external fear, one way I heard it, is that it's specific and constructive, right? There's a particular thing, German Shepherd, okay? Now we'll be constructive. We will run faster than Bolt down the street. But the thing is what happens in some cases is it may come from the outside, but then it moves inside you. And what it does is fear moves inside you. John Ortberg puts it this way. I think it really made sense to me. Is fear often comes and it comes inside, unpacks its bags, signs a long-term lease, and makes its home there. And then when that happens, we become worriers. I guess the correct technical word is anxiety. Traditionally, fear is external, anxiety is internal. So kind of what David is, he's dealing with fear in the first verse, anxiety in the second verse. Exterior fear, first verse, interior fear, the second verse. And he says this, many are saying, in verse 2, we go to the second level of fear now, anxiety, and he's saying, many are saying of my soul, that's internal, there is no deliverance for him in God. David is not just in fear of his enemies on the outside, but now it's starting to bug him on the inside. And maybe what they're saying, if you go back again to 2 Samuel, it's like these guys are saying, do you remember King Saul that was before David? And God rejected him because Saul rejected God and he messed up and God just wasn't with him anymore. Well, David, that's what's happening to you, man. You messed up. You ever get that voice in your head? God's abandoned you, man. You've messed up. You're a Saul. He's not with you anymore. Well, David's kind of expressing this thing, and these people are telling him, listen, there's no deliverance for you from God anymore. You've done some terrible things. You had an affair with Bathsheba, and then you murdered Uriah. Man, you've blown it. You forfeited your right. What that means is David is not just being attacked externally, but now he's dealing with all this internal stuff that has unpacked its mind, and he's having to walk around with it inside him. His very identity is under attack. I like to listen to or read stuff from pastors who have secondary degrees in behavioral sciences. Sometimes they're fascinating, the way they filter the insights of some behavioral scientists through the Word of God and what you come up with. Keller certainly does that. Ortberg studied psychology, does a great job with it. Campolo was a sociologist. And one of the guys that they mention lots of times, I mean, you just say the guy's name, you know he's a heavyweight. Rollo May, I think. R-O-L-L-O. How many R-O-L-L-Os do you know? I mean, this guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about, right? But he wrote a book that a lot of them really revere because he did a study on anxiety, and it's called The Meaning of Anxiety. And what he basically, the premise, what he ended up with was this. He says, anxiety is what we feel when our existence as selves is threatened. In other words, David's very self is being threatened here, his identity. You're not a king anymore. You've blown it. You know, what are they saying here? They're saying there's no deliverance for him anymore. Why? Because you're not a good king. You're obviously not a good father. You know, and there's so many ways to accuse him. You're not even a good follower of God. Look at how you messed up here. So his very self is being threatened. His identity is being threatened. It's kind of interesting because you can see both sides. Example that he gives is that you can see the both sides of fear, both levels, physical fear and internal anxiety, that kind of fear, both in a professional athlete. A professional athlete, when they're playing, there's a good kind of fear. It's like, man, I better catch this pass because if I don't catch this pass, everybody's going to say that he blew the game, you know? And you get that extra boost of adrenaline and energy and the fear of not wanting to miss the pass. You're able to run and you're able to do things that you probably couldn't do had you not had that fear during the game. And you see things. Sometimes you see plays and you can't even believe, how did they do that? How did that happen? I think the guys look back at it, or the girls, depending on the sport, look at it and say, I don't know how I did that. You know, and so they have that, but then they retire. And what can happen is now their identity is gone. Everything that they have based their self-esteem on and so forth is gone. And so the fear that was healthy on the outside, now there's a new fear on the inside, an anxiety. Who am I? What am I really worth anyway? Something that was their security is gone. It's no longer a fear that's a momentary burst of energy that galvanizes you for action. But now it's almost like you could have a thunderstorm, right? That comes in. That's almost like fear from the outside. Comes in, you get the lightning, you get the thunder, you get the downpour like you get these sometimes in Florida, right? Then it's done and it's gone and the sun comes out. It's nice, you know? But anxiety is sort of like what we had this week. It's like 34 degrees, drizzling rain for like 3 days straight, you know? And that's kind of how anxiety is. It's just in there and hanging out. And David's dealing with this. And after he describes it, the next word he says in verse 3 is but. That means something's coming up. He's not going to live there. He's not going to stay there. But means he's going to do something about it. I looked up the word but, and it says grammatically, yeah, I looked up the right one, not with two T's on the end, you know? I think we know what that is anyway. But the one with one T on the end, grammatically, but is a word used to introduce something that is true in spite of either being or seemingly contrary to what has just been said. Something's just been said, man. I got all these people after me. I got all these armies after me. They're looking to kill me. They're all undermining my identity and my self-esteem, saying, you know, how can you even expect God to be with you? But, and then he's about to say something. So here's David, he's sunk down into fear, but, and now he's going to show us how he gets back up out of the fear. Step one, he's going to recognize that he's got protection from God. When you're sinking down in there, remember who your protection is. Remember who's with you. Remember who's got you covered. He says, but, you, O Lord, are a shield about me. You know what's interesting too? He says a shield about me. One of the commentaries, I don't know much about this stuff, but I just tell you what the commentaries say. It says that there were two kinds of shields back then that they would use. There was one that was used in hand-to-hand combat. I guess it was more mobile. It was just a small round one. So you could ward off blows and fight back. But there was another one that would actually be the size of a door that would actually be kind of around you. In my version here, it says a shield about me. In other versions, it says around me. And it would actually have, kind of an arch to it. And it almost covered your full body. And it wasn't just to protect you from danger. It was to give you the ability to walk into danger as you followed the general. When they would actually besiege or look to go into the enemy lines, you would use this shield. And I think in a lot of ways, that's what God does, right? He doesn't say, I'm going to protect you from the danger, but I'll protect you as you go into the danger, right? Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego. I'm not going to keep you from the furnace, but guys, I'll meet you in the furnace. Because it's in the furnace that he does his greatest work sometimes. And so David is saying, you're not a shield for me. You're not a shield to me. He's saying, you're a shield around me. It's like a very telling phrase. He's leading him not just to protect him from trouble, but perhaps in trouble. I know following you, no matter how bad things are get, somehow you're going to work this stuff for good. You're going to shield me. Doesn't mean I'm not going to get hurt. And if God lets you get hurt today, it's because he wants to save you from a greater hurt tomorrow. Boy, I tell you, certain lessons that I learned earlier in life, I thought, man, this stinks. Why is God doing this? But later on in life, it's like, yeah, remember when that happened? Yeah, well, we're not going to go there again. Maybe if a loss that has happened to you is simply so it will shield you from a greater loss in the future. Sometimes following the general leads you right into the thick of things. Jesus followed him right into the tomb, didn't he? And there was apprehension. God, if it's possible, take this cup from me. God's protection, though, only works if you follow the general and you obey him. You start getting nervous, you let the fear, the anxiety get to you, and you want to back out and you want to run, a shield doesn't work. You try and run with a shield the size of your body and it doesn't cover your back. You turn around and start running, you're in trouble. His protection is with us as long as we keep following him and looking to him. You know what? Obedience is hard, man. I don't have to tell you that. You know, just trying not to lie once in a while. It's, you know, to just stick to that sometimes is tough, you know. So we call them little white lies, you know. You know, come on, we're going to start figuring them out. April 15th is coming, right? Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, God understands. Come on. You know? I mean, you know, all these things and my favorite scripture online is it's an abomination to God, but a very present help in time of danger. Oh, no, not really. I'm mixing up scripture. Okay. But really, that's kind of how we feel sometimes, right? And so obedience is hard, but you know what? Disobedience is lethal, people. When you start thinking you want to back out, man, just remember, it's hard, but the other choice is lethal. It's lethal. So recognize your protection. Next one is he says this. He goes, but you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the one who lifts my head. Now, don't forget that but still goes with that line too. But you are my glory, and you're the lifter of my head. Lifting of the head is usually something that has to do with feeling proud or confident, right? Come on, get your chin up. You know, keep your head up. It's all right. You're going to make it. But what David is saying, listen, I got my head up, but the only reason it's up is because God keeps my head up. God's the lifter of my head. He's my glory. Well, it seems to indicate then, is it possible then at one point these things, God wasn't his glory. Were there other things that kept his head up, that kept him proud? Well, it's very possible. I mean, we just talked about it. And you know what's funny? If he kept his glory. He kept his head up because of other things. God kind of took care of that, didn't he? Well, I'm a popular king. Can't really say that anymore. Your own son's got thousands of them following him to rebel against your leadership. Yeah, well, what are you going to say? Illusion's kind of been destroyed. I have a great moral record. I had power, not anymore, you don't. All this stuff that he perhaps had his confidence, that was his glory, that kept his head up and kept him feeling good about himself, God stripped him of all of it. It's gone. And you know what? When that happens, you get anxiety. But God allows it sometimes to help us to understand that, David, your identity, your confidence, your self-esteem can't just rest in your moral record, your family's love, your approval of people, your political power. You've got to relocate all this stuff in God's glory. You know, we will always live in fear to the degree that you put your trust in something that can die. That's just the way it is. And there's really only one thing that can die. God himself. These other things are good. And we need to have them, sure. There's a natural part to having self-esteem and feeling good about yourself. But one way I've heard it put, I think it was that study we did a couple years ago, and he said, when a good thing becomes an ultimate thing, that's when you're in trouble. Because if that thing goes, and it will if it's not God, it's going to leave you absolutely devastated. You'll always live to the degree that you put your glory or your trust in something that can die. So we've got to not only recognize our protection, but we've got to position our confidence and glory in the right thing. Can't be in ourselves. Can't be in other things. It's got to be in God. Third step out, and there's just two more. The third one is that he's responding to forgiveness. You see the confidence that he has here? Here's a guy that is in all this trouble, and he says in verse 4, I was, and he answered me from his holy hill. And before that, he says, he's the lifter of my head. He's my glory. Not only that, he answers my prayer. Where does David get this kind of confidence? I mean, come on, Dave. You know? I mean, you have adultery, you murder some guy, and it's like, yeah, man, he's going to answer me. Oh, really? Where does all this come from? You know, what is going on here? This guy is confident, you know? Where does this come from? Well, the first hint, I think there's two hints here. The first hint is, he says he's going to answer me from his holy hill. Well, what does David think? God's only up on the hill there? Is that some kind of primitive Old Testament concept? No, I mean, we know David doesn't think like that. Read Psalm 139. He says, if I lie down, he's there. If I go in the deep, he's there. Wherever I go, God's there. He knows that. But he's saying there's some clue there. He says, I know because he's going to answer me from the holy hill. Well, what's up on the holy hill? Mount Zion, tabernacle, sacrifice for sin. He knows God's got his sin covered. God has made provision to deal with his sin. Not only that, another insight that I saw and I thought, man, that is cool. I wish I could claim it for myself, but I can't. Notice the parallel between what David says in Psalm 3 about God being his shield and glory. In the midst of his fear, all of a sudden Dave says, listen, there's all this stuff coming against me. There's these armies coming against me. I'm scared. But in the midst of being scared, he says, you know what? You're my shield and my glory. It's a direct parallel to Genesis 15 when Abram was scared. And God comes to Abram and he says, Abram, you're scared, aren't you? And God says, I'm your shield, I'm your glory. I'm your great reward. I'm your shield. Abram, you don't need to worry about it. You don't need to be scared. I'm with you. I'm your shield. I'm your glory. Now, that's Genesis. That book's an old book. It'd been around a long time. I'm sure David was aware of it. And I don't think it's any accident that his words exactly parallel. He finds himself in fear. We find that his words exactly parallel what God spoke to Abram when he was fearing, when he was scared. And not only that, what's interesting, when God said that to Abram, Abram says, well, how do I know? You know, I mean, that's good, right? That's a good thing, you know. Well, God says, I'm with you. I'm your shield. I'll be your great reward. Really? Well, how can I know that? God says, remember this? This is great. This is one of the best chapters in all of the Old Testament. Because when Abram says, well, how do I know you're with me? How do I know I don't have to be afraid? God says, well, if you want a guarantee, I'll make you a contract. But see, back then, they didn't just get out a paper and a computer and like, okay, let's get a lawyer, let's figure out. No, this is, when they did a contract back then, man, it was like serious. They get out the animals, they'd get a heifer, they'd get a goat and a ram and a couple birds. They'd cut them in half, put them on each side of a trail so that the blood of the animals would make a path, and you'd have to walk through the path and say, you know what? If I break this contract, may what has happened to these animals happen to me. Man, maybe we should bring that back again, huh? Certain contracts don't seem to work out, you know? I mean, but that's what they would do. And Abram's like, man, am I going to walk through that? I don't know if I can keep all my promises to you. You know what? God walks the path for him. So Abram doesn't have to walk it. He says, listen, man, I'm going to promise to bless you. Even God walks through, he says, I'm going to promise to bless you even if I have to pay the penalty. I'm going to take responsibility for both sides of this contract. I'm going to bless you even if you mess up. You know what? It's all on me. Then I'll pay the penalty. I'll be the one to be cut to pieces. And you know what? He was, wasn't he? That's what Isaiah said. He said he was cut off. For our transgressions, he was bruised. He was punished. I don't think David knew what you and I knew, but he knew enough that God had sworn that he would rather have himself die and have himself punished than to have us thrown out. So David's got this confidence. It's unbelievable confidence. He remembers his forgiveness. He remembers his protection. He remembers who his glory is. And the last step is, he remembers others. That's the thing. Notice the very last line. The very last line is, not the next to last line where he's going to punch out the guy's teeth, but the one right after that, he says, real help comes from God. Your blessing clothes the people, or your blessing be upon your people. You know, and it seems kind of weird. Is he getting really mad there because he's talking about, punish these people and knock out their teeth? And sometimes, you know, we are kind of proud as modern people. We talk about our emotional honesty. And then we read a line like that and we're like, David, take it easy there. He's supposed to. But the thing is the Psalms are so real. The emotional reality of the Psalms. And David says, but you know what? I really am that mad. But it's not that he's just mad. He's looking for true righteousness. He's looking for justice. He's realizing that God has called him to lead these people, and he's not to just lie down and let this other guy take over, who's going to be a deplorable leader, who happens to be his son, and it's going to run everybody straight into the ground. He's saying, listen, I need to stand up for justice, and not just for myself, but it's about other people, for the other people. You know why? Because the opposite of fear, the reason you have to think about other people and not just yourself, if you want to get rid of fear, is because the opposite of fear is love. You know, I reminded of that the other day too, because we often think, well, the opposite of fear or the opposite of love is hate. It's not. according to 1 John 4:18, it says perfect love, like I said before, drives out fear. So it's fear, not hate. Why? Because love is self-giving. Fear is self-absorbed. See, when you go to love, you've got to do something for somebody else. Fear tends to be self-absorbed. It's all about me. Oh man, what if I get laid off? Oh man, how am I going to pay these bills? Oh man, what did the doctor say at that last visit? Oh man. It becomes so self-absorbed, and David realizes, listen, I've dealt with myself. I need to remind myself I have protection. I have forgiveness. I need to know where my glories and who holds my head up and all of these things. But I can't just be focused on myself all the time. I can't just be like, I got to have peace. I got to get peace. I got to have inner peace. There's a point where you got to get to a place and you got to think of somebody more than yourself. Fear is basically thinking completely of yourself, and David knows it, and he's not completely out of his pit of fear until he takes this final step and starts to care about somebody beside himself. Your blessing needs to be on the people, Lord. Let it be upon the people to get out of his pit of fear. Sometimes we just take our eyes off of ourselves. I mean, that's really the premise of AA, isn't it? That's what Dr. Bob and Bill W., when they started that, they realized, man, if all I'm thinking about, I got to have inner peace, I can't drink, I got to have inner peace. You know what you need to do? Go find somebody else that needs help. And they found, when they got their eyes off of themselves and started looking to somebody else, the drinking urge left them. That they weren't so self-absorbed, but they started allowing love to eradicate the fear within them. And they went out and they looked to help other people, because you know what? There's healing in helping. You need healing for your fears, then go help somebody. Healing in helping. God will heal you of your fears and sometimes through your fears. We don't want to just follow God with our fears, but we want to follow Him through our fears. He's a shield about you. He's your glory. He's a lifter of your head. Go tell somebody else about it. Let's pray.